Now, joining me on the virtual couch today is a woman who believes very strongly in the power of radio to change lives. Can't imagine where she got that idea. Not like everybody in this building feels the same way. But so much so in her case that she actually gave up her high-powered job in banking consultancy about 20 years ago to work on this project of using wind-up radios all over the African continent, recognizing that they could be a source of crucial information and of education for under-resourced communities. Her name is Christine Pearson. She is the founding CEO of Lifeline Energy, and in the last 20 years or so, they have distributed close to 700,000 of those wind-up radios with differing degrees of impact and penetration all over the continent. Christine, it's wonderful to have you with us on Cape Talk. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's only my pleasure.
As our listeners will hear, the accent is American. You were born in California, but South Africa's been your home for quite a long time, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. 32 years, as a matter of fact.
Okay, but it was a trip to Mozambique, I believe, that set this whole thing in motion and changed things substantially for you. Christine, won't you just briefly tell us what happened on that trip?
Sure. So when I had stepped away from my banking career and was invited to start up a nonprofit that could distribute power-independent radios to rural areas, I didn't know anything about radio. I didn't know anything about development. And so I took some of these original model wind-up radios into rural Mozambique. And I sat on the ground and spoke to rural women about what they listened to, about what they learned. And they looked like I had come from outer space or something. They had no idea what I was talking about. Because despite all the millions of dollars being spent on radio programming for the poor on the continent, the penny dropped that women weren't actually listening to it. They didn't have any way to do so. If they had radios in their family or in the villages or communities, they were owned by men, and men would often take the radio, the batteries out of the radio, so women couldn't listen. And that's been something I've come across quite widely in many different countries. Information is power.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. When I used to lecture a radio course, I would always tell my students with so much pride that in South Africa, we have 99% radio penetration, that in even the most far-flung remote rural village, somebody will have a radio and a number of people can listen to one radio at the same time. But what you've just said, Christine, proves that that doesn't always work in practice, that one radio might be kept private by that person or for some reason kept away from the rest of the community.
Right. And before there was widespread electricity or solar options in rural areas, batteries were the only way to power radios. And batteries are expensive. You have to buy them on an ongoing basis. Women typically in the past didn't have access to much money. And, you know, we'd say when batteries die, learning stops. I mean, there have been so many times when batteries have precluded having information access, which is why it's so important to have an independent power source. So we started out with wind up, and then as solar progressed and became smaller, then really all of our products are primarily solar powered now, mm-hmm. whether it's radio or MP3.
I mean, Christine, reading your description of those early days, and I read how you described a trip to Rwanda where you found all these children sitting using their big crank wind-up radios in Kigali, but that wind-up power only lasted 30 minutes, and then they had to stop and pause and wind and crank again to get the power going again. As you said, when the batteries die or when the power runs out, the learning stops. The kind of learning we're talking about here is incredibly diverse as well. You're not just talking about children having access to distance education. You're talking about things like public health information and programs for expectant mothers, for example.
Oh, absolutely. Radio is used for everything that you can imagine. And it builds on the rich traditions of oral learning and storytelling in Africa, which is so, so powerful. And there's very few things that are very few programs that can't be put to radio. It remains a very powerful medium.
Now, in the particular context in which we're speaking, a world in the grips of COVID-19 and lockdowns, any way of getting material to learners by a remote method is absolutely life-changing at the moment, because so many schools are closed, children don't have access to internet very readily, to access online schooling. Has your organization stepped up at all to try and speed up access to radio-based learning at this time?
Yes, indeed. We've been involved in radio-based learning from the very beginning, starting in Zambia, actually. There was a huge resurgence. You know, if you look back 20, 25 years ago, there was a huge resurgence in radio at that point because of HIV and AIDS. That was the only way to communicate with people about that disease. Now we saw that in West Africa during the Ebola crisis. Mm-hmm. We put many tens of thousands of radios there, and we've seen another renaissance of radio right now. There are so many countries that actually have radio school lessons, but they haven't been using them. And now they are again. And children are listening either in groups by social distancing. So we're getting a feedback from countries like Sierra Leone, where we have quite a few of our large distance learning Life Player MP3 radios, where children are social distancing, but they're still getting their school lessons or particular programs that teachers may not have the skill to teach, like science. We're also finding that we're getting a lot of requests for smaller radios so children can listen to programming at home.
Christine,
and COVID information. That has just been so critical and important now.
I mean, it's amazing hearing you referencing the use of radio in the early days of the HIV pandemic, because I'm actually busy reading a book about those scary times of the mid-1980s when the disease was first being recognized, and there was so much fear and so much misinformation that I can imagine it must have played a crucial role in sorting out myth from fact and getting that kind of information to healthcare workers. One of the sad things reading this book I'm busy with is that the healthcare workers who should have been stepping in to help people who were dying of AIDS were too scared to go near them because they had been given misinformation that they'd heard from a colleague or passed along from an unreputable source, because they simply didn't have anybody else filling that void with factual information. So who is providing the content for all of these programs going out to make sure that what is reaching the radio users at the end is quality, well-checked information?
Well, governments, first of all, and many NGOs and UN agencies, mm-hmm. the effort that we're seeing for COVID-19 is unprecedented, really, in trying to get information out in different languages. And that is what's so important, because I don't think people really realize, unless they travel in rural parts of Africa, that English, Portuguese, Swahili may not be widely spoken. You know, in Kenya, where I happen to be right now, 64 languages are spoken. Yeah. You go out in rural areas, they don't speak Swahili. They don't speak English. They need to be communicated to in their own language, and that's where community radio comes in.
Yeah.
And there's something like a 2,000% increase in community radio in the last 20 years in Africa as well, which has been phenomenal and so helpful and so important.
Before we talk about the next big project, I want to share with you a message coming in on our SMS line from Giles in Somerset West, who is listening to us on his wind-up solar radio, who just wants to say well done to you, Christine, on a great job. And he's enjoying listening to us on that kind of radio. I said 700,000, I think. Is that figure accurate, the number that you've managed to distribute in the last 20 years or so?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, some radios, if they're in a family situation, it may just be five or six people. But we have many instances where one radio will cover 200 students.
Wow.
You know, they'll use different classes. I've been into many classrooms across the continent where you'll find 150 kids in one room.
Sure.
Or under one tree. Yeah.
Sobering stuff. So, yeah. Now, Christine, one of the reasons we've got you on today is to talk about the next big project, because you have a dream of a kind of YouTube for radio, a radio voice bank. It's a concept sort of like podcasting, but on steroids. Tell us a little bit more about what you wanted to build.
Yes. So obviously, spending so much time with people, and particularly women, I'm always curious about what they want to learn and what they want to know. And I've realized, with the huge emphasis on youth that we have on the continent, which is very important, the youth pulse of, you know, 60% of the population being under 18, that rural women are being forgotten about, because women over 35 or 40 never had the opportunity to go to school. How do they learn information? How do they get information? And podcasting has proven itself in urban areas and in the developing world to be hugely and immensely popular. So it's taking this concept and creating a platform that would start first on smartphones and eventually go to feature phones, whereby an unlimited amount of audio content could be placed on that platform, and wherever you are, you'd be able to listen to the language that you understand. So it's not an app.
Mm-hmm.
And apps are really important, this is so much broader and so much wider to ensure that nobody has to be left behind because there isn't a language they can't understand on the internet or on radio.
How are people going to access that information once that bank has been built up?
Well, initially, it'll have to be on smartphones, and we'll collect a lot of data and do a lot of research around this. Mm-hmm. And then our developers will look to put it on a feature phone, which is still the most common phone. So how the mechanics of that would actually work, we're not clear yet. But it would enable people to, say you want to learn beekeeping and you speak the Maasai language. So you would put in Maasai or speak the word Ma, which is the Maasai language, mm-hmm. and then you might get some options of health, education, livelihood, something like that in your language. You'd press that button. If it's on a smartphone, you'd see the icon, you'd press that, or you'd hear the subject said aloud, and then you'd be able to access, just like you can on YouTube, a whole series of audio content, but it would always be in your language so you'd understand it.
Amazing.
And there are, I wouldn't even venture to say, Pippa, how many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of hours of audio content, once it's played, right now it's lost forever. There's no place to store it to replay it on demand, and that's what we want to create.
So how far down the road are you in finding partners to work with you on curating the content and on ways of distributing it to the people who need to use it?
Well, we're pretty far along on our concept of what we want to do. We have a team in Kenya. We have a terrific technology partner in Source Fabric out of Prague who will work with African developers. We know how we're going to do it, and then we're busy talking to various content partners now to sign them up when we're ready to do so, that this will be another for their channel for their content. Even if they have a YouTube channel, or even if they have a website with all their content on it, still the big providers would want to come on because it just gives them another channel as well. It also gives topic experts in local languages an opportunity to share their knowledge. It'll give storytellers a chance and elders to tell the stories of the ancestors and of their cultures, to keep so many great African cultures alive. So there's just so many possibilities for this. We're pretty far, so to answer your question,
Yeah. We're
pretty far along. We're learning as we go. We want to pilot it in Kenya because we feel that Kenya is the best country to give us the biggest slice of Africa, that what will work in Kenya will probably work in other parts of Africa as well, given the 70% of the population is still rural and the majority of farmers are pastoralists.
Exciting times ahead, Christine. Lots of people simply applauding you for the effort and celebrating the concept of the solar or wind-up radio. And Faith, I particularly like your WhatsApp saying, this has been wonderful work for so many years, leading change through a device that is so simple yet so transformational. I grew up listening to radio and it's easy to take it for granted these days. A big thumbs up to them all. Faith, we never take it for granted. We love coming to work in radio every day, so I'm glad you feel the same way. And Christine, thank you so much for sharing this incredibly positive story with us today. It's a great pleasure to have had you on the show.
Pippa, truly, it's only my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Christine Pearson, the founding CEO of Lifeline Energy. Great to have a positive story to share with you that involves our favorite medium, and I hope you enjoyed that conversation. We continue to take your questions, your calls, your SMSs and voice notes after the 1:30 news headlines. We are, of course, going to play a round of Brain of Cape Talk, and there's a quite formidable competitor sitting in the reigning brain's chair, so it could be an interesting round at 1:30. We're also standing by to talk cars with Chiro, so if you have a motoring question, now is the time to start typing out your email, please, to pippah@capetalk.co.za, or you can leave it as a voice note on 072-567-1567.